Welcome to Pleb Chain Radio, a live show brought to you by Plebs for Plebs, which focuses on the intersection of Nostr and Bitcoin protocols. Join QW and Avi as they run down the weekly news and developments, breaking down the current thing and the future frontier with the foundation of decentralization, the builders, thinkers, doers, and plebs. All right, we are live.
Welcome, gentle plebs, to episode number 87 of Pleb Chain Radio. Today is Friday, the 15th of November, and it is 5:53 p.m. on the east coast of the United States at the time of recording. We have a fun show ahead of you today. Dan O'Prey, former chief product officer at Bakkt, and most recently co-author of an in-depth report from 1A1Z on the state of funding in Bitcoin Core development. Will be joining us to talk about his journey through Bakkt and through Bitcoin before that, and then the report itself. Just a reminder, if you are listening to the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, first of all, thank you for listening, but I would urge you to hit pause and switch over to the Fountain Podcasting app, where you can earn some sats and support the value for value revolution as you listen. The show is recorded live on Nostrness and streamed live on Zap.stream, Nostr, Amethyst, and any other client that supports streaming. But on Nostrness especially, there is a live chat to accompany the conversation, and that can get pretty lively with memes and whatnot. And for our meme readout today, it is that time of year. It is the most wonderful time of year, QW. It's NGU season. And for that, we have an old reliable, the line of urinals meme, where we have one fine gentleman doing his business in the far left corner of the line of urinals. And you have another person walking up. All the other urinals are empty, about 10 or 12 of them. But walks up right up to this first gentleman, proceeds to start doing his business at the adjacent urinal, and whispers gently in his ear, 93K.
Did you assume gender, Avi?
That's a good point. But with dear leader in charge, I think we can say anything we want. Wokeism is dead, QW. And you've been following Nostr and Bitcoin culture,
QW. Let me. I just thought of this. Lightning Store, the Pleb Chain Radio black and yellow shirts. There's only small, medium, and large left, Avi. We're completely out of XL, so there's no more XL black and yellows to ever be pressed again. Isn't that fascinating?
And let's not forget, no more XS's as well.
Yeah, that's true. And when NGU means your belly gets a little bigger too, right? I mean, that's you you're more of a food enjoyer.
Well, maybe not. I can afford better food. Yes.
So when those sell out, we're going to switch to, I believe, and I'm almost confirmed that purple and orange, I think that's going to be the next one, which is going to be fascinating. But if you do buy on Lightning Store, use the promo code PLEBCHAIN. That's just going to give you 20% off. That doesn't do anything for us. It's just 20% off the store. So it's an awesome store. Anyways, where were we at? Culture Corner. Yeah. So I think our guest just arrived, and what's going on today? I think there was probably some pre-party yesterday and the day before, maybe this week in total, but adopting Bitcoin's going on. The one other thing that is upcoming, and shout out to Open Mic and the Toonster group, they're putting together an independent music summit December 15th. That's going to be in Austin at the Bitcoin Commons. So I love to see the culture, and I'll just keep pumping the culture, especially the music side of things, because I think that's the where value for value can touch the quickest.
And QW,
yeah.
Rumor has it that the man himself, Open Mic, the face of the value for value revolution, might be gracing our show right before that Austin event.
There, it, I, you know, I think we do. We're kind of a staple show when it comes to upcoming culture shows, right, Avi? Or cultural events.
We shill them.
That's such as cool. Noster and Value for Value.
We shill them free of cost.
But that's it. Short of the pandemonium with the NGU and the culture right now, and obviously the post-election hangover, I just want to get back to normal again, Avi. I'm looking forward to this holiday season. Maybe have a little bit more extra time to concoct up some ideas, have some fun with the group, the community, and that's it. We're already halfway through November, which is just nuts to me. Noster November.
Well, getting back to normal, QW, I'm afraid that's not happening. And then for our sermon today, it is a question. Is NGU the biggest driver of adoption? There is a prevailing narrative, QW, that people seem to be particularly fond of, which is, and they say NGU is what drives the most adoption. There is nothing like NGU.
And define adoption.
Well, exactly. So my answer to that is it's not. NGU does not drive adoption. It might be the biggest driver of curiosity, though. You get all of these tourists who suddenly hear about this thing and they come in. But how adoption is the thing that makes the tourists stay and become believers. What NGU does is it leads these folks to the edge of the rabbit hole. But many need a little push, or dare I say, QW, a little pull to get them into that rabbit hole and go all the way down. And this is a topic we keep hitting on over and over again on the show. That's what culture is for. That's what culture does. And I will say, compared to the last bull cycle, now our culture is a lot more cohesive. There's so much more content. This past bear market was a treasure trove for all sorts of videos and film and songs. And now Bitcoin adjacent apps where musicians can come in, like Wavelake, Fountain Now, Valley for Valley podcasting app. There is so much more to make that make the culture sticky. So I think we have a better chance this time to grab more people into the movement.
One thing interesting is, so obviously this time there's the ETFs, right? And so when people are doing NGU and they're like, oh, I'm going to buy some, and they buy an ETF, it's not like it used to be where, I mean, shit, 6 years ago, 8 years ago, you'd be on some kind of decentralized random purchasing app with a hot wallet and you wouldn't really know what you're doing. But then there's Coinbase and all the other different exchanges that came and went over the years. But you learned how to transfer Bitcoin. You started to understand what, you know, that you could actually transact with it. I feel like the NGU, some of the adoption that would come to that ETF just would not be the kind of cultural adoption. It'd just be like a place to put money, I suppose.
Oh, agreed.
And you never understand the beauty. I mean, I think when you send your first transaction, you know, there's a little bit of stress involved, a little boomerism going on, and then when it finally actually meets or reaches its destination, there's a sense of euphoria, I think, that a lot of people are going to miss out on when they're not touching the actual Bitcoin.
Well, I will say, QW, if there is a person who finds a deep emotional connection or meaning mm-hmm. by logging into their Charles Schwab account, I would be a little concerned for their mental well-being.
Yeah, but I think, but you know, going back to just my own personal experience, like without NGU, there would never have been an awareness, I suppose. I mean, that awareness where, oh my gosh, it's going up, you know, Lambos, whatever. That's what kind of leads you to that shitcoin path, because you understand Bitcoin, you start to learn about Bitcoin. You're like, well, what's the next Bitcoin? And that's when you start to really truly understand, well, what is Bitcoin? There is no next Bitcoin. And then you start to say, well, what's special about Bitcoin? But, you know, what I want to say is it starts with a kiss. You certainly have to touch it, have your first experience with Bitcoin to start to really think, all right, what's down this rabbit hole? And we had that show with Rob, and I just started thinking about that. Discovering Bitcoin is discovering yourself. When you start to look into Bitcoin and you start to see the cypherpunk core ethos, the sound money, the permissionless freedom to transact with anybody, anytime in the world. It's something that's, I think those are principles are ingrained at a very primal level. So I truly think we are Bitcoiners at birth. But we just discover Bitcoin in us, as a natural fit, I suppose. I don't know.
So society, we're born Bitcoiners. Society, evil society leads us astray.
Yeah.
And we find our way back.
Well, because to leave the matrix, you have to enter the matrix, right?
Fair enough.
So there you go. Get deep, Bobby.
Getting deep, my friend. It's a little too early on a Friday night for that. Haven't even had my first glass of wine. But it is time, QW, to welcome our guest to the show, Dan O'Pray. Welcome to Plebchain Radio.
Hey guys, thank you so much for having me. I wish every podcast I joined started with a good old urinal anecdote. So that was quite the intro.
Yes, it is our meme readout, Dan. We do that. We do one every week.
Very cool.
If Avi wasn't so eloquent with it, right? I mean, only he can make a urinal meme just sound just poetic, right?
He did an excellent job.
So, Dad, we've got to start with a burning question. Has Hyperledger become the future of finance yet, or do we need to wait a little longer?
Oof, wow, right off the gate. I mean, it's definitely coming anytime now. I think we all know enterprise blockchain's the future, and this Bitcoin thing's just a fad. So just you wait, but no.
And I think some of our listeners are probably wondering what that is. So we'll get into that in a second, Dan. But maybe a good way of getting into that is to talk about your journey. How did you get into this space?
Yeah, so not to go too far back, we're all born Bitcoiners, but around say like 2008, I discovered Ron Paul, who I think brought many people to libertarianism, and then particularly to Austrian economics. And when I started looking into that, really very eye-opening learning about central banking and what money actually is and how it works. And there's a whole alternative to everything we're taught in schools. And I grew up in London, and Keynes is God. So discovering that really was like really refreshing and super interesting just to learn, hey, there's a whole different way about thinking of economics. Then fast forward a little bit, I was living in Beijing in 2013 and came across the white paper and was sort of primed for it with everything that I'd been digging into. Had a cloud computing startup at the time, so was thinking about distributed systems generally, and then coming across something that was the intersection of distributed technology with Austrian economic basis was super exciting for me. So really got straight down the rabbit hole pretty quickly after discovering that.
You mentioned Ron Paul, and you were living in Europe at the time.
I can't remember where I was living at the time I found Ron Paul. I think it was still in England. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Because Ron Paul was he was a huge influence on a lot of us. And it was kind of a big deal. And that's kind of one of those things where he was just speaking truth that we needed to hear, because it was one of those things where a lot of us were born libertarian too. We just didn't necessarily know it either. In that respect, but his teachings, his principles, it just hit the nail on the head with so many Bitcoiners. It's just interesting to hear someone that was not in the States that was so inspired by Ron Paul.
Yeah, and I mean there definitely weren't many of us that I know of in England, but I started just learning about the American system and Ron Paul and gold bug and started getting interested in gold, right, which is what he was preaching along with Peter Schiff and co at the time. Fortunately, before I had the chance to buy some gold, I quickly discovered something even better.
But Dan,
I'm picturing that meme that I'm in it for the tech with the guy with the chains.
Exactly. But Dan, that wasn't you made it sound like happily ever after 2013. You discovered Bitcoin. There is a part of the story not dissimilar to mine where you strayed a little bit from the path, Dan. What happened there?
Wow, I lost my way. Yeah.
You want to hear about the car crashes?
So yeah, it was 2013, and I was just leaving my previous startup and thinking about what to do next, and didn't really know what to do in Bitcoin at that time. Like, I needed to make money. I just had a baby. I was living, just got married. Wanted to do another startup, but really didn't know, if Bitcoin was going to be around for a long time, or how I could build a business or really contribute to helping it succeed. So I did go and explore what's now, called one of many different things, but blockchain technology is probably the most general term for it, on the sort of private blockchain or enterprise blockchain side. So I'm happy to say no shitcoins, but looking at how you could use blockchain, particularly in traditional financial services, and sort of understanding on the post-trade side of things, how you can synchronize multiple different organizations and back office processes using this new technology to explore that. So started a company called Hyperledger at the time. And really that was, we were looking actually, the initial inspiration for that was still quite libertarian and Austrian economics side, because it was inspired by Friedrich Hayek's book on denationalization of money. And so originally it was called Mintet, which we were attempting to create a platform for which companies any form of private entities could create private forms of money. So the original goal, or like holy grail we had in mind when we first started, was if we can create something that an Amazon or any large company or private entity or local currency could create their own private competing currencies with different properties from mainstream fiat currency. But that quickly evolved into more of a sort of general purpose, tokenization platform of real world assets, right? None of these terms were the terms of the day, but what they've become to be known as. And really summer 2014, saw a big influx of banks and interest from traditional finance and Wall Street. And the hype became, the meme at the time was blockchain, not Bitcoin. So ashamed to say I did contribute to that, but very, very different use case. I was still a Bitcoiner at heart and really just trying to see if there was some adjacent space that could be leveraged as a starting point at the time, where bringing assets that already existed onto a blockchain could help as a stepping stone towards the more decentralized future that we wanted to see.
And when did the penny drop, Dan? And what did that look like when you said, it's not going to happen?
To me, they're a totally different worlds. So I know a lot of people think it's blockchain versus Bitcoin or shitcoin versus Bitcoin. I always saw the blockchain space just as almost completely orthogonal. Right. So I was always a Bitcoiner. I always believed in Bitcoin. I always owned Bitcoin. I wasn't trying to, compete with it as such. Did take quite a while. I mean, the long, long story short, Hyperledger ended up being acquired by a company called Digital Asset, which is where I met Avi in New York, and stayed there for about 6 years or so. So all in all, it was probably 7.5-ish years of exploring, can this work? I wouldn't necessarily say for sure that it can't, I think what it will end up looking like is just so radically different from from Bitcoin or from what people thought it was going to look like back then. Really, it's a way to synchronize enterprise workflows across companies, right? It's not particularly sexy or thrilling or in any way competing with Bitcoin. But Bitcoin was my passion, and I got into the space for peer-to-peer electronic cash. I care about using Bitcoin as money. I care about the monetary properties and the lack of central banking and intermediaries. And so it took me a while, but after those 7-8 years, I wanted to return to that passion.
There was you did move on to a company called Bakkt. So for folks who don't know, and Bakkt is obviously Bakkt has a crypto footprint, but it is a fairly significant player in the Bitcoin custody world as well, right? So could you, for those who don't know, could you give some background on Bakkt?
Sure. Yeah. So Bakkt span out of the Intercontinental Exchange or ICE. So they're one of the world's largest commodities and futures exchange groups. They're less unknown, but they are the owners of the New York Stock Exchange as well. So they're also in the equity space. And they started internally a project to spin up a crypto arm very, very early. In fact, they were one of probably the first major financial institutions of any kind to touch Bitcoin with their physically delivered Bitcoin futures product. And then they essentially span that company out, the futures and custody product, as an independent company called Bakkt, B-A-K-K-T. And Bakkt then went public on the New York Stock Exchange and served as a institutional custodian initially solely for Bitcoin, but that did expand to about 8 coins in total. And then acquired Apex Crypto, which was a crypto brokerage platform. So again, so it supports 8 coins, which powers some of the large retail brokerages that don't do in-house crypto trading. So Webull.com, Public.com, later Swan Bitcoin became a client, and several others. So if you were trading crypto through those retail applications, Bakkt was the brokerage platform and custodian on the back end, similar to Fortress Trust or Prime Trust or a couple of others in the space, if people are familiar with those.
QW is very familiar with Fortress and Prime Trust. He's done a lot of sleuthing on the topic.
Ah, Las Vegas, man. Prime Trust, didn't Fortress open up like down the street? Who's that one, the one CEO of them that moved over to Fortress?
It was a few of the ex-executive team of Prime span out.
I was reading into that, and it was funny because the guy took, they ended up taking the season tickets of the Raiders, and they moved them from Prime Trust to Fortress. So it was like they just renamed Prime Trust down the street and kept the same deal. And then Prime Trust went down. I don't know. It was just funny. But that was one of the shows we did probably a year ago, Avi, huh?
Yeah. It was back when all of the shenanigans were going down.
Yeah. Oh, man.
So Dan, then you moved on from Bakkt and you started a company, it's not a company, maybe it's a collaboration.
good question. What is it?
Yeah. 1A1Z. So before we talk about what it does, talk about the significance of the name itself.
Yeah. So, way back when I was sort of thinking about starting my own thing and was just sort of brainstorming some ideas. And 1A1Z are the first 4 characters of the public key that Satoshi mined the Genesis block to. Love the subtle Bitcoin reference. Went and paid for the .com. Get them nice, easy to spell, easy to say, hopefully memorable .com as well. And then I also like the sort of juxtaposition to Andreessen Horowitz and their A16Z, right? So would like, you know, been exploring a potentially venture capital style firm or a venture studio style firm. And, you know, Andreessen and Horowitz were a firm I used to respect immensely. Mark and Ben Horowitz. But really, you know, they've gone all in on, you know, being one of the main offenders of the, you know, part buy, pre-sale, you know, pre-allocation, and pump various different tokens and dump onto retail. So I liked also the juxtaposition to, you know, 1A1Z versus A16Z being Bitcoin and freedom tech focused only.
I just want to dwell for a couple of moments, Dan, on the beautiful symmetry in that name, because that's the public key from the Genesis block, 1A1Z, 1 Alpha, 1 Omega. There are no coincidences.
There we go. It was all meant to be, and luckily I managed to find the .com.
All right. So what is the goal, or what is the mission statement of the company?
Yeah, so really, you know, the general hypothesis is that, you know, I'll skip all the obviously Bitcoin is going to succeed part, because I presume I'm preaching to the choir on that one. But generally speaking, Bitcoin has the best engineers and the best engineering talent. And a lot of those engineers are starting Bitcoin companies or Lightning companies or Nostr companies. But, you know, the most of the sort of business people, I'll say broadly, you know, product people, marketing, sales, other functions that are less technical, tend to go towards the more crypto space, right? There's more features, more functionality. Bitcoin's old. Bitcoin doesn't do as much. XYZ coin is new and sexy and has all this, you know, huge functionality and massive budget from, you know, token sales. So people outside of core engineering or technical functions, I believe, tend to get pulled more towards the crypto side of things, in part because they're not technical and they don't fully understand why Bitcoin is better and why they should be working on Bitcoin, and in part because that's just where a lot of the money is, right? So really my goal, you know, in exploring this is to create an organization that can support Bitcoin and broader freedom tech engineering-led founders build businesses, commercialize, fundraise, and go to market, and sort of plug some of the gaps that I see in the Bitcoin ecosystem. In what fashion that takes place, TBD, still evolving, have ideas, but really just wanted to start, just doing, research on the Bitcoin space, bringing awareness to how it's funded in particular, and then a variety of different ways that we'll add on top of that to support Bitcoin-only companies.
I like to think crypto is like the spirit of the boy and the Bitcoin's the wisdom of a man type of thing. Sometimes you got to grow into Bitcoin to truly, truly appreciate it. And then after you see it, then everything else disappears. It's just kind of like a very complete feeling once you're Bitcoin only.
I agree. And, you know, I think a lot of people did take that path, as you were saying earlier, of, you know, number go up, quick money, get into shit coins, then discover Bitcoin and why it is better. But there's also a lot of people that don't, right? And they stay there. So it is difficult to explain to many people why they should go Bitcoin only long term, and particularly for businesses when they've got pressures from their investors. They want to see a return. They want to, why don't you have a token? Why wouldn't you have a token? Obviously, you should have a token, because that's the only way anyone makes any money in this industry, right? So
yeah,
being a Bitcoin startup, you actually have to build a viable business that creates products that people want to pay for. You know, it's crazy, crazy talk, but it is certainly harder to monetize than a quick buck on an ICO.
Yeah. Yeah. And breaking that fiat mindset, I think a lot of us are accustomed, especially if you're a Ron Paul acolyte or Austrian economics, you know what fiat is, you know the money printer's the devil, and it wrecks everything it touches. But It's tough to kind of push the Bitcoin point across when there's so much more to it to understanding it. Just versus a conversation you can't just have at one dinner table.
Absolutely, and in many ways, crypto is fiat on steroids, right? They have their own money printer, and they raise at valuations that, if you were a typical business raising money in Silicon Valley based on metrics, you would not be a $1 billion company with 10 daily active users, right? So suddenly you've got all this money, and you don't have the sensible, needed, real pressures of having to spend that wisely and having to listen to market signals and having to listen to users. And it can be extremely distorting to have too much money, and a bad thing.
So distorting, you don't even know where the yield comes from.
It's yield wrapped in yield wrapped in yield.
Just don't sell all at the same time. So I was looking into your report. You're doing three of them.
That's the plan. Yeah. So we're looking at, Bitcoin Core, open source developer funding. And the reason we're doing it in three parts is because it's, ended up being such a big topic. And first part, we're focusing kind of in the middle on the organizations that, raise money from donors and distribute it to the developers. Then the second part will be on the actual developers themselves, and the third part on the donors. So just looking at each of the sort of three groups of stakeholders and doing a bunch of interviews and diving into and speaking to the core people in each of those cohorts.
And anybody wondering what report that I'm talking about, the first one I will put in the show notes. I'll put the link in there so you can feel free to read about it. It's enlightening, and I certainly appreciated it. So tell me about kind of what the scope of the report was and where the idea came from.
Yeah, I mean, really, it was myself and a friend, Mass, who we were just chatting about, how is Bitcoin? We've both been in the space for quite a while. How do core devs actually get paid, and where does that money come from, and who decides who to give it to, and how do people make a living working on Bitcoin? Right, 10 years ago, you could mine Bitcoin, and you had that incentive of, if you're contributing, then the value should go up and you should get a return. Nowadays, that's not practical for individual developers, and so really we just realized that for how long we've been in the space, how much we depend on Bitcoin, for how many people have made so much money around it, it's surprising that we didn't know very much about how that whole process worked. We started Googling, expecting to find here's an explainer or an overview, and really there wasn't very much. There's a couple of old blog posts here and there of snapshots of grants that have been given at certain points in time. But there really was no, explainer or overview of the landscape into how core dev funding works at all. And so in the spirit of open source, we decided, hey, let's do it. Let's go and, best way to learn is to force yourself to publish something. And just started reaching out to each of the different organizations and trying to find out how they look at things and what their perspectives are and where they see challenges or issues or areas for improvement. And we're overwhelmed by the level of engagement we got to, from some of these organizations. It was so glad someone's actually asking, right? People are interested, because we all take it for granted that there are going to be developers pushing security patches and, doing general maintenance, even if you put aside adding new features, new functionality, just keeping Bitcoin as it is alive today requires developers. This is live running production software securing $1.8-ish trillion. Who pays them? And so it was a bit of a shock to learn that, not only was there not an overview out there, but it wasn't something that seemed to have that much awareness, or people weren't even really asking that question. I tried to fill that gap by doing a series of interviews and trying to distill it all down into to a paper.
How would you know in this type of completely open-ended scenario that you've landed on an exhaustive list of donors and or sources of funds, let's say?
So, I mean, you know, basically we spoke to, you know, the heads and board members and senior personnel at a variety of the organizations. And of course, we checked with them, like, are we missing anybody? Who else should we include? Who else should we talk to? And the reality is there's just not that many of them, right? So that we identified 13. There's, you know, less than that. I'm sure there are still, you know, some that do it quietly. Or some that didn't want to be public, but you know, they're relatively small in terms of, you know, amount of funding. But ultimately, you know, developers need to know where they can get funding from. And if you're completely stealth and no one even knows to ask you for funding, then you're probably not doing a great job. So these 13 are probably, you know, pretty exhaustive list of those organizations. But yeah, it came from speaking to developers, speaking to each of the organizations and asking them, you know, who else is doing this.
Well, one of the interesting things that comes out of the report, I mean, there's a lot of interesting things in the report, but there's an important distinction, right, to make here between developers and maintainers of Bitcoin Core. So could you tell our listeners what is the difference between a core developer and a core maintainer?
Sure. I mean, the high level is, so there's 5 Bitcoin Core maintainers. They've changed over time. On average, there's rough, you know, there's been about 5 at any point of time, sometimes, you know, ever so slightly more, but typically 5. And those 5 have the added privileges of being able to actually merge code into the Bitcoin Core open source repository on GitHub. So any developer can, you know, can fork Bitcoin, can submit a pull request and propose to make a change, but only any one of these 5 can review and merge that into the Bitcoin Core code base itself. Now, that doesn't mean, right, a lot of people hear that and they think, wow, Bitcoin's, you know, controlled by 5 people and they can do whatever they want and, right, they got superpowers. You know, of course, that does not get pushed out to your node and running. There's a whole, you know, build and release process after that. And then node runners have, you know, have to update their nodes in order to bring that code, you know, to the network. So there's several more checks and balances beyond that, review processes beyond that, but essentially these 5 are the ones with the rights to actually update the source code, which is then ultimately run if there are no issues.
And there's a surprisingly small number of core developers that you identified in the report, right? Something like 41, right?
41, yes. Yeah, so we looked, you know, we, of course, all of this is public and transparent and on GitHub, and you can clone the Git repo and dive into all the stats. So we looked through, we somewhat arbitrarily took, you know, from the start of this year and at least 5 commits. So a commit being, you know, a batch of code that is proposed to be changed. Which is not, you know, an ideal metric, but we looked for, yeah, number of developers who've done at least 5 commits that were merged by one of the maintainers over the course of this year. And there were 41, you know, active developers by that definition, which is, you know, is not huge and is historically about the same, you know, number. It hasn't grown meaningfully or shrunk meaningfully. It's always remained around that 40 number.
And there was $8.4 million of funding that went to these developers. Is that correct?
In 2023, by our estimations of what is publicly reported from, you know, many of these organizations are not-for-profits and so do release their spend numbers. And so that's why we had to cover 2023. But yes, overall, $8.4 million is the number that we got to, and were able to verify, you know, privately with each of these organizations for total spend going towards Bitcoin Core developers only in 2023.
So what is that? That's about 200K on if you were to uniformly distribute them, that across the devs, right? 200K each?
Roughly, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so for high skilled engineers who could work in Silicon Valley and make 2-3 plus times that, it's not a huge amount per individual.
And did you interview the developers for this report, Dan?
We did some. Yeah, we spoke to a couple of the maintainers and several developers. That wasn't the focus, but we wanted to make sure, as that is part two, the focus, where we're going to speak to far more and do the whole interview process. But yeah, we wanted to make sure, we knew the right questions to ask, these organizations as well. So yeah, spoke to a couple of the maintainers and some developers across the world.
I'd have to imagine, well, first of all, the money's presumably not spread out in a uniform distribution across all of these developers. But even if you just assume that it is, right, we're talking about maybe a little under 200K actually per developer for a job that each of them is well aware is an incredibly important job for a fairly modest pay. Did you find in your...
And to add to that, Avi, it's a $1.8 trillion market cap asset,
Yeah. right.
You think that layer of protection, that thin line, would be appreciated a little bit more, maybe.
Right. But I'd have to think this has some kind of impact on their mental health.
Well, yeah, I mean, so again, we haven't fully dug into that, and that will be, not to leave everyone on a cliffhanger for the next part in the report, but that did come up. But I think, interestingly, from what we've garnered so far, actually money or lack of money for individual developers, and maybe there's some survivorship bias here, right, of the ones we're talking to are the ones that are getting paid and the ones that are still around. But there's a whole host of other, non-financial issues that come with being a Bitcoin Core Dev too. It is a very political space. People get very, very passionate about what they think Bitcoin is or what it should be, and are very vocal about that on X to Core Devs or Bitcoin Core as an org. And so there is a lot of, other elements, including, harassment or concerns or, right, just being known to be a Bitcoiner and presumably having a lot of Bitcoin and the security threats that come with that. And then also the legal side as well, right? So Craig Wright was actively suing, Bitcoin Core developers, and there was a legal concern of being sued or a legal concern of being liable for anything that Bitcoin comes with it. And then we've seen even more generally government agencies across the world going after developers of privacy preserving tech with mixers and coin joins, but not exclusively. And so there's a host of different concerns, particularly for mental health and for the sustainable retention of these 41 developers long-term, beyond just financial incentives.
So on the face of it, if you're looking just at the amount, the $8.4 million, set aside what the source of the funds, which is the next layer of concern, we'll get to that in a second, just from the number itself. If I look at that and just based on what we talked about, that's a concern for me. You didn't paint it as much of a concern. You and your co-author didn't paint it as much of a concern in your paper. Do you want to talk a little bit about why you think it might not be as big as I think it is?
Yeah, I mean, obviously that's entirely subjective. Our goal wasn't really to give an opinion or necessarily like takeaways, but we just wanted to, you know, to the best of our ability, report on facts and trends, and not be too alarmist, right? We obviously want to raise awareness of this, and it is a relatively small number, especially compared to, you know, even to other crypto projects, let alone traditional startups or enterprise, you know, companies. But I think the reason, you know, personally wasn't too alarmed by that is that a lot of the new organizations, a lot of the new funding that has come in this year. So we've seen a lot more organizations be created. In fact, I think there's about four in the last 3 months or so of new orgs with new sources of funding. And so, yeah, we obviously don't have the public data to determine this from, but we expect that to, you know, increase pretty dramatically in 2024 with new funding that is, you know, some of which is public and new organizations, and then some new funding and new organizations that aren't necessarily public yet. So it is a small base, but it is, from what we can tell thus far, trending in the right direction, although, you know, obviously still not massive.
Do you think the number go up attributes to more donations?
I think number go down contributes to less. So yeah, I guess some way of saying it. But
I think it's funny. Just a gentle pleb like ourselves, when Bitcoin goes up, I feel like there's a human reaction where you're like, oh, I didn't stack enough. It's going up. I didn't get enough sats. One sat equals one sat. I need more sats. So you see a little less generosity on the Zap side of things, I feel like. But when you, let's say you're a whale and you have a lot, I mean, you might have an opposite pressure where you feel like you might need to be giving back more.
Yeah. Yeah, and definitely there is a correlation between the market price of Bitcoin and the amount of donations. And there were, you know, we give a couple of examples of organizations in the report that had commitments or went through tough periods when we were in the, you know, like the 2021, you know, bear market, that some of the commitments for donations fell through, or just, you know, donations overall, you know, fell. So maybe an important point, you know, just to call out on that is each of these different organizations have different models, but generally either they're supported by voluntary donations externally, or they're supported by, you know, some private funding source, whether that's their founders or a corporation. But certainly the ones that that rely on purely voluntary donations, it drops pretty materially when the price of Bitcoin drops.
And with the ETFs, I believe there was two that announced that they would be donating to Bitcoin Core devs. It was VanEck and Bitwise or something like that. Did any of those actually follow through in your knowledge?
They did. So they both made pretty long, like 10-year commitments to donate a share of the profits of their ETFs, which I think is awesome, and something that I think would be great to see a lot more companies follow. So I don't mean to take anything away from either of those organizations here. I think both of that is fantastic. But it is a share of the profits in a highly competitive ETF space where fees are very, very low or zero for the next, like, you know, first 6 months, right? So after the Bitcoin spot ETFs launched, there's a land grab for volume, and the way you do, you know, win the land grab is by being as cheap as possible or free. And so, to my knowledge, there hasn't been a significant amount of money coming from those yet, because they've all done, you know, introductory low fees or zero fees.
Yeah.
But as, you know, as those fees return to a more normal steady state, and as the size of those ETFs grow over time, then it could become a more material source of funding.
Did you look at any, I mean, we're talking about Bitcoin Core right now. Did you look at any other implementations of the protocol, like Knots or I can't remember the other one?
I mean, the short answer is not really. I mean, certainly in talking to some of the developers and you know, looking through like what's the best way to bring more developers to the space, Bitcoin Core being written in C++, and which is not the most, you know, accessible language or most commonly learned or exciting or wanted to be learned, right? There's a lot of interesting excitement around Rust and Go and other C-like languages that maybe have more developer share. But you know, the reason we didn't is because Bitcoin itself is pretty monocultural around Bitcoin Core. You know, the overwhelming majority of Bitcoin nodes on the network are Bitcoin Core nodes. So unlike some other protocols that have a little bit more diversity in the client software, Bitcoin is very, very monocultural. It's going to be a tiny, tiny fraction of any of the numbers. There are no organizations dedicated to funding alternative implementations, to my knowledge.
Yeah. Going back to the developers, Dan, some of them are, the report lays it out, right? Some of them are actually employed by these organizations, and some of them are sort of lone wolves, right? Independent contractors or what have you. What is the distribution there?
So that's something that we're going to, you know, get more hard facts on, but by and large, it's significantly more on the grant side versus the employment model. There aren't actually that many organizations that do employ core developers today. Really, there's the Brink and Chain Code are a couple of the largest in London and New York. MIT Digital Currency Initiative also employs, I believe, like 3 core devs. And then there's one other new organization, 2140 in Amsterdam, which was literally announced at Bitcoin Amsterdam pretty recently. So is getting off the ground. So there aren't a lot. And Spiral and Blockstream on the privately funded side. So there aren't, you know, many organizations where core devs can be employed. Many prefer employment and the benefits and security and stability that comes with that. But a lot of Bitcoin developers still love, you know, freedom and flexibility and being able to live wherever they want in the world. And so the grant model is by far the more significant number of developers that are being funded, and that's also reflected in the size of, you know, the total funds, which was about 50% higher on grants than employment.
Imagine that, Avi. Bitcoin Core devs like freedom. How many Bitcoin guests have we had, Avi? How many pleb guests that were nomads at one time of their life? Van life.
Oh yeah, at least half.
At least half.
Have you ever lived in a van, Dan?
I have not, but I would love to. I do have 2 children, and a house and other expenses and health insurance and things I need. So
you grew roots, Dan. You grew roots.
Yeah, I got stuck.
Got cement shoes.
Exactly.
So I obviously, from the Nostr side of things, our momentum really came from that initial Jack funding in December. Well, at least the announcement of it in December 22. When I'm looking at your report, there's a glaring elephant in the room, and that's the centralization of kind of the donation side of things. And Jack Dorsey seems to be one generous guy when it comes to Bitcoin development as well, just like Nostr development in freedom tech in general. Is there a solution to this where he takes such a, obviously we lean on Jack, thank you, Jack, but you know, that's not the ultimate long-term goal, right? Is there a solution?
Yeah, I mean, the the ultimate solution, right, isn't that Jack does less, it's that others do more, and we need more Jacks or more pot Jacks or more.
Well, he can still donate the same amount, but maybe the percentage with more other donations,
Exactly. Yeah, no, he has been, as you say, incredibly generous. And also, interestingly, from all accounts that we spoke to, each of these different organizations, extremely hands-off, right? So he is not funding things with direction of how to spend these funds or being involved in that decision process. He's literally sort of, you know, deliberately and in some cases by design, blindly donating to orgs rather than free to distribute those funds however they like. That's awesome, and he's been, you know, great and core to funding in Bitcoin and Noster, and hopefully that does continue. But there, outside of Jack, there's, you know, really, you know, four or five other individuals who are making meaningful contributions or actively supporting or running these organizations. But, you know, that's a handful of people, of individual people. And Jack in particular, you know, given his means, has been large to exclusively, you know, funder of at least three of these orgs. Really rely on him. B Trust received 500 Bitcoin from Jack and Jay-Z, and that's all of their funding to date. You know, Spiral is part of Block, where Jack is the founder and CEO, and so they're solely funded by Block. And then OpenSats, which I know does a lot in Noster as well and has a dedicated Noster fund, is about 97%, about 91% of their funding has come from Jack Dorsey individually as well.
For compliance reasons, they can't be a nonprofit if it's more than a certain percentage from one donor.
There is a challenge around that. Yeah. So, you know, any of these organizations that are registered 501c3s or not-for-profits do have a pretty large incentive to find other donors, or they would have to reduce the number of donations they're receiving from him.
So, Avi, are you saying that if more people donated to OpenSats, Jack would donate more? Just to hit that maybe cap?
Maybe. But Dan, let's think about let's go through a thought experiment. Let's do this objectively based on the findings of your report. If Jack were hit by a bus today, and assuming there's no dead man switch, right, where suddenly like all his billions flow into these orgs, what happens to Bitcoin Core development?
Well, a lot of these orgs have his money already, right? So heaven forbid that should happen, but these donations will still remain, obviously, and there's no way for him or his estate to claw any of those donations back. And I think, you know, surprisingly, despite, you know, the 8.4 million of last year being a very small number, some of the orgs were not too concerned about the level of overall funding for their orgs, because they're all, you know, they're generally being fairly conservative with how they distribute. Right. So they're looking at, you know, different paces of distribution for each of the different organizations. But they've got Dorsey's funding, and they're, you know, he's pledged to fund in some cases over several years. And so they're looking at, you know, what if we don't get any further funding? How much runway will we have based on just the funds that we have today? But I think, you know, more to the point of your question, there would be, you know, on a go forward basis, a big hole there. You know, we're talking about tens of millions of dollars, which, you know, given the total numbers is hugely significant. So we would need to see other individuals, high net worth individuals, step up, more companies step up, and, you know, ideally more individual smaller donations making a larger portion of that.
Yeah, let's hope. And again, to QW's earlier point, hopefully NGU will
whale bring guilt. That. Whale guilt.
Well, you know, a lot of people who weren't whales could become whales, right? At least in dollar terms.
Dorsey is
one transferred like I don't know 2,000 Bitcoin a day, and he's been holding since 6 cents. So I'm just like, wow, what a legend!
$170 million or something from nothing. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because as NGU goes up, you wonder what people's mental price tags are with some of these holders, you know, and you start to see the movement on chain. You're like, interesting. That's interesting. Gotta love the open ledger, right?
Dan, did you look at that transaction on mempool.space?
No, I just landed in El Salvador, so I just saw it on. Oh, I saw it. Yeah, I saw a screenshot of mempool. Yeah,
it's almost magical because there's. It's about 40. It's essentially a consolidation of 40 UTXOs of 50 Bitcoin each. So he mined those in the Genesis epoch and just let them sit there. And then it's almost like time travel. You see these things from way back in the past converge into one giant 2,000 Bitcoin UTXO. And then, of course, he's probably sold it for fiat now. He or she sold it for fiat now.
I'm sure there are no conspiracies about who that may be at all.
Avi, are you assuming there's only two genders, he or she?
I think now it's safe.
But yeah, I mean, Dorsey is, Jack is, you know, extremely wealthy, both through Bitcoin and through Twitter and Block. But you know, I don't want it to feel like you have to be his level in order to contribute and to support Bitcoin. As a regular, normal, boring millionaires, right? Poor non-billionaires who can also step up and do a lot more in this and individually as Bitcoin hits 80, 90, 100K. There, a lot of these orgs accept, you know, small donations and, yeah, not to get too funding drive on you, but every little counts. And while the number is high, if you've benefited from Bitcoin, then consider giving back.
Yeah, it's just a bigger riddle too with open source, protocols between Nostr, Bitcoin, which we touch almost daily. Avi, how do you drive funding? How do you drive development when you're trying to break the fiat mindset? Not go into that kind of VC control route, and you want the freedom, you want the open source development, but somehow you need to survive too. And it's just a riddle that we're trying to solve it without, you know, pre-mines, right?
Yeah, I mean, I've worked in the open source space before, you know, with the Linux Foundation for 3 years and, you know, looking at different commercial open source business models, you know, making money directly from open source, you know, without a token it is a big challenge. And there were, you know, I think one of the things I would love to try and like sort of strengthen the point of is the, you know, commercial feedback loop of these companies that are making money today around Bitcoin should feel the need to support the open source project itself so that it can be more successful, so that they can be more successful. And that was one of the things that the Linux Foundation, you know, did really well, right? But there is no foundation for Bitcoin. It's been sort of tried. But as we see more profitable, more viable companies built around Bitcoin who are making money from Bitcoin, a bit more social pressure perhaps or internal recognition that those profits and revenue depend on Bitcoin itself, and there is an onus to give back there. But of course, you have the free rider problem, right? If you don't and everyone else does, then yeah, you've got away with it. So there is no direct correlation, direct tie to commercial success of giving back.
Yeah, that makes sense, Dan.
We got it. We got to pump the culture, Avi. We got to pump the culture, expand the use case, expand adoption, and it's all downstream there.
Yeah, it's a virtuous cycle, or it ought to be anyway. Just because for the reasons you said, Dan. Now, a few months back, the rumor mills were swirling with the story that there might be a counterbalancing force to Bitcoin funding. Someone saying, "Well, why does Bitcoin really need to be funded?" Maybe sort of it's the ossification side of things, right? Why do the developers need to be funded? This counterbalancing force allegedly talked one of the ETF providers out of donating some of their trading fees, a share of their trading fees to Bitcoin Core. Did you find any truth to those rumors in your research? Did you even look into that at all?
We did. There's certainly that counterbalancing force that I guess we're not going to name, but apparently that force has changed its tune a little bit. But yeah, I mean, generally there is, you know, kind of two camps, you know, just to oversimplify it a little bit. There's the, you know, Bitcoin ossification camp, as you say, that, you know, Bitcoin doesn't need to change very much. We don't need to add much. And therefore, the assumption is that we don't really need many developers to work on it, right? Because it's perfect as it is and it's already running. So let's just sort of leave it and run. And obviously, I'm oversimplifying that a little bit. And then there's the camp of we need to, you know, add more features, more functionality, improve privacy, add governance, right? And Bitcoin needs to change in order to be as potentially, you know, potent as it could be. And so people, you know, some in that first camp kind of, you know, there's maybe a misconception that, you know, live running production software that we all depend on doesn't need to be just maintained, right? And if there's a great initiative called Bitcoin OpTech, that was originally started out of Chaincode and is now resourced by Brink, that has a podcast and runs through a lot of the changes to Bitcoin that do end up getting merged into Bitcoin Core. And a lot of them are just, you know, there was a bug discovered a while ago, or there's this security threat that needed to be closed, or we need to, you know, update it for new operating systems, or some downstream dependency changed in some library. And if we didn't modify Bitcoin to change based on that, then everything would break, right? So I was very surprised to learn, you know, just quite how much development is needed just to keep the lights on. So even if you do believe Bitcoin is perfect as it is and should never change, you still want those developers working on security patches and making sure it stays just as it is. So I think that's a pretty key thing that perhaps some don't realize quite, you know, how critical that is, even if you're not in the let's merge governance tomorrow camp. Just to keep the lights on still needs developers and still needs funding.
And those voices, you seem to suggest, Dan, are no longer as loud on the topic.
From what I've heard, that maybe some learning has been had there.
Excellent. Well, so for this report series, you're focusing just on Core, right? You're going to then, the next one, did you say, is going to be the interviews with the developers, and then the third one is going to be with the sources of the funds? Is that right?
Yeah, donors and companies, and perhaps, you know, a bit more focus on some of the ideas that have been raised throughout this process of what we can actually do about it and how we can help, you know, be a catalyst and set up things like that maintenance versus innovation one that we just discussed, right? Maybe these orgs should have a donate here if you want to just maintain Bitcoin as is, donate here if you want to change Bitcoin, right? So give people a bit more granular control so that whichever camp you're in, you can still donate.
Have you considered after the series, maybe looking into either the application layer funding or Lightning funding or potentially any other Bitcoin adjacent protocols, Nostr for that matter?
Yeah, got a long list of stuff I would love to do, and you touched on a couple of them. One is just, I'll give you just what's in my mind, right? One is looking just like L2s and side chains and actually putting some definition around what those things are and what isn't. We've seen a sort of explosion in, layer twos claiming to be Bitcoin layer twos, that some maybe are more than others. There's just far more of them now. So looking at each of those and trying to put some rigor around that conversation before just everything under the sun. I heard someone actually claimed, Ethereum is a Bitcoin L2 because you've got wrapped BTC on it. Right. So what's your definition? And then you touched on another one, like just the Bitcoin venture capital or Bitcoin native or Bitcoin only venture capital landscape. There used to only be 2, 3, 4 funds that were focused on funding companies in this space. And similarly, seen a bit of growth around those more recently. Would love to also get to Nostr and really into that. I think the funding story there, just from what I understand, is pretty simple today. So the current, this report's about 20 pages. I'm sure that one will be a little bit shorter, but really just digging into Bitcoin adjacent technologies, not just how they're funded, but helping further awareness and sort of understanding of what those mean.
I'd love a report that would give me a definite answer of whether ordinals made Bitcoin fun again.
No, is the answer. Just a one-word report. Take ordinals back to Solana.
I will say, Dan, once you start moving up layers, right? If you're looking at the application layer, especially, or the L2s like Lightning, potentially Arc, I would think the finding the sources of funds could start getting more challenging because at the base layer, you're really just looking at grants. There is no VC funding. I mean, that it makes no sense to VC fund a protocol. But at the application layer, they're probably... And some of these fake L2s, right, that are just companies that are spinning up shitcoins. How would you be able to track all of those private funding sources, which are not grants?
It would be more looking at the actual venture capital, starting from the VC firm perspective rather than necessarily the applications, right? Working your way backwards from there. So just be of the VC funds or other forms of investment vehicles that are dedicated to solely funding Bitcoin or Freedom Tech, where are they investing? What are their the site? How big is that landscape, right, relative to the crypto landscape where they do, as we mentioned, have Andreessen and Horowitz and Paradigm and many other organizations with material funding, and just sort of comparing and contrasting that space versus the crypto space versus the general tech space. The L2 one, I think, would be more of a one of my general concerns is that it's great that a lot of projects want to be associated with Bitcoin now, but we're going to end up in a similar spot to some of the downsides in the crypto space of having just scams and nonsense, and that's kind of par for the course of being more open and permissionless and having more people be able to do more things on Bitcoin. But unless there is a more clear framework to what these things actually are, being built on Bitcoin doesn't necessarily mean anything anymore. So I think that would be more likely the scope of that area of research.
And what is the end goal, really? If, like, you're going to have 5 or 10 reports. It's going to take you a painstaking year or so to produce all of them. I'm guessing.
Well, I haven't committed to those ones I just thought about. So, yeah.
And I'm guessing you're not getting paid for this. This is a passion project.
Exactly. Where does the yield come from?
I mean, so the yield, the immediate yield is learning and connections, right? Like I wanted to learn more about this, so that's why I did it. There really wasn't much more to it than that. And I thought it could be helpful for Bitcoin too. So, this is hopefully in part a way to contribute back and to raise awareness. And maybe there's some Bitcoin whales out there who are just like, oh yeah, I never really thought about that. I never really thought that, Bitcoin core devs don't have clear ways to get funded and the money's so little, and maybe people will step up on the back of this, and that can be part of my contribution to giving back to Bitcoin itself. It's also been a fantastic opportunity to network with the inner core for no pun intended of Bitcoin, right? Like 11 years ago, one of the things I loved about the Bitcoin space was how small it was and how everyone sort of knew each other. And now we've got BlackRock and senators and countries involved. It has a different vibe. But going back to the few amount of organizations and the few amount of developers and very few amount of maintainers, it's an incredible opportunity just to meet these people, to learn from them, and then ultimately, selfishly, to figure out what I want to do now to make money on top of that.
Yeah, I can definitely relate with that, and I'm sure Avi can too. We're in the unique position where we get to interview and talk to people in the space, whether it's Bitcoin or any freedom tech adjacent space. It's just amazing to be it's a class, essentially. You get to network and you get to learn the whole time. So it's
And how much does
Jack, that's where my yield comes from too, Avi.
so Dan, the real question is, at what dollar price of Bitcoin do you become a whale?
How many figures do we need? Define a whale. I'm still not going to answer. I don't have any Bitcoin, of course. So.
Yeah, exactly. See, that is the answer, Dan. Yeah, none of us do.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, look, I have done a public sacrifice. I gave all my Bitcoin away in 24 in my book. You invested it all in Hyperledger and now it's gone.
I helped a bunch of banks be slightly more efficient in their clearing processes. It's a good course.
Right. So what's next for 1A1Z apart from the reports?
And apart from adding follow us on Noster at the bottom of your reports instead of X.
They're both there. right on the end.
I got an email. I got follow us on X and join Signal.
On the about page, there is a Noster link.
There you go.
So you can look for that little ostrich. To answer your question, Avi, there's many different paths from here. The obvious one is just advising and consulting with Bitcoin companies that are early stage and don't necessarily have the skills in house, and helping them position themselves, explain what they do in ways that not just engineers can understand, and explain how the value of what they're doing can translate into commercial success, help them fundraise, a few different parts from there. But really just this is currently mostly passion projects, loving learning, loving meeting all of these incredible people that actually make this stuff happen. And if I can't figure out a way to, you know, make money for myself out of that down the line, then shame on me.
Love to hear that, Dan. Shame on you, indeed. KW, you have anything else for Dan?
No, we're involved in our own passion project here, Avi, and I'm looking down the road, and it's shame on us too. At one point, right?
This is definitely a passion project. We are anti-revenue here.
Anti-revenue. That's an interesting model. Return all the zaps.
Just all write-offs, Avi. No big deal.
Well, everything we get zapped. This is actually true, Dan. Everything we get zapped or boosted on Fountain, we just circle that back into Fountain. Yeah, and
awesome. We'll do promotions. And when we sell a shirt on Lightning Store, I love Lightning Store. They're my buddies. He's my buddy local. But that percentage of profit that we get from shirts go right back into Fountain too. And what I love about Fountain is when you listen, you get paid sats. So we are decentralizing sats eventually, which go back into Noster and get zapped back. So it's our way of contributing to a circular economy, which we call the pleb wheel.
And that is awesome. And we need more initiatives and companies. It doesn't have to be 100% of your revenue necessarily going back, but yeah, 5, 10, 20% would be great to see. So that's awesome on you guys for committing to giving it all back.
Well, I mean, ultimately, it's the success of one is a success for all. Rising tide lifts all boats, and it's someone's gotta. I mean, the culture has to expand and has to be sticky. It has to be somewhere where people want to be, where people want to grow. But they're learning from the ethos of Bitcoin, all the way back to the cypherpunks, in my opinion.
Very cool. Well, thank you for what you do, and yeah. Thank you for having me on and being interested in the report and let me talk through some of the points.
Yeah, certainly enlightening, Dan. I would recommend everyone listening to read the report. It's going to be in the show notes. I would characterize it as somewhat troubling. I know Dan and his co-author have taken a far more pragmatic approach to how they describe the funding situation. But nevertheless, it's a worthwhile read, and I'm looking forward to the next two parts of the series.
Well, and like Dan said, Avi, if we're taking a bearish look at it, we never would have even thought about it until we read a report like this. So it's something that, you know, these things need to be highlighted. Problems need to be. We are a problem solving community, so we just need to know there's problems in places.
Yeah, and that was kind of the conclusion, right? It was more areas for improvement than it was, you know, houses on fire. But yeah, no, there definitely are issues. There definitely are ways that, you know, significant problems that if aren't addressed will become alarming if they're not already. But yeah, the first step is to just try and lay those all out and figure out what can be done to fix them.
Trigger an immune response. That's what we're doing here.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, it was a pleasure meeting you, Dan. I hope to meet you in real life one day, maybe at one of sailors' parties, whale parties. anything else, Avi?
No, that's it. Appreciate it, Dan. I know you're in El Salvador. You just landed before the show, and you must be anxious to go and do whatever people do in El Salvador, spend their back.
eat dinner and drink beer. Yeah. Yeah.
anything planned or anything specific since you're there?
Going to a group dinner after this, and then there's a couple of after parties arranged tonight, and then I've got to figure out what's going on tomorrow. It's been a bit of a whirlwind tour. Just got here from Guatemala as well, so I was in Mexico before that. So it's all been a little nuts.
Yeah. Wow, traveling the Southland.
And jumping around Central America, and yeah, been to El Salvador a couple of times now for adopting Bitcoin. So really also excited to see how much it's changed and how Bitcoin adoption has changed, particularly for merchants. The first year I came, it was kind of Starbucks and McDonald's were the only two places you could spend Bitcoin, and everyone else just looked at you like you were crazy. So excited to see if that's become a little bit more mainstream. Now that they've had some time to roll it out.
Wow. We certainly excellent. Appreciate it.
Enjoy, well, right.
Anybody so listening? Much, yeah. Anybody listening, please, please, please support Value for Value Movement. Listen on the Fountain Nostr client. Listen to the podcast, boost it, zap it, comment, spread the word. We really appreciate it, and we'll see you next week.
Goodbye.